Welcome to ESLAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Anna Stellinger. Anna is the Deputy Director General of the Swedish Confederation of Enterprise, where she leads the work on international and EU affairs. She took up this position late last year after having been the Director General for the National Board of Trade in Sweden for 5 years. Previously in her career, she has been the director of the Swedish Institute for European Policy Studies, and she's been working for think tanks and research institutes in France. Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Fredrik.
So we are going to talk about the pandemic and the consequences it has had for trade in Europe and possibly for trade in the world, topics that you have worked with closely for a very long time. I want us to start by talking about new trade restrictions that have been imposed during the pandemic. There is this example which has been circulated in Europe of a Swedish medical equipment company, Mölnlycke, because it found itself under export restrictions in France that made it impossible for the firm to ship their products to customers in countries like Italy and Spain. And it's one example of how export curbs have damaged the supply of key medical equipment in Europe at this testing time. But it's far from the only example of restrictions that have interfered with cross-border exchange in the past couple of months. And I wanted to ask you, looking at it from your vantage point, what type of problems have businesses faced because of pandemic trade responses?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. I sit down on an almost daily basis with big companies, small companies from all various sectors. And it's true that we see how the corona crisis is hitting basically all sectors of the activity quite hard. It goes from absolute darkness to lighter shades of grey, but it's easier to quote those sectors that are not affected than the ones that are affected by the crisis. And even if Sweden is a country that remains relatively open, where the economic activity hasn't been completely locked down, it is still clear that this crisis is something quite different to the crisis we have known so far.
And in what way does it differ? Is it sort of the scale and the volume of things, or is it also because there are sort of specific dimensions that may concern sort of policy responses that we haven't seen being introduced in past crises?
Well, look at the Swedish example. Sweden had a huge crisis in the 1990s, but that was a crisis for the country of Sweden and our economy, less a crisis that was global or European. Then again, we had the financial crisis, 2008-2009, which was more of a global crisis. And now that we have corona crisis coming on, it's clear that this is both a crisis here in Sweden, it's a European crisis, it's a global crisis, and it hits us at a speed that we are not used to. And what we can see is that there are so many obstacles currently in this crisis that we are not used to. Take just one example, the free movement of people. We need to move people across borders in order to deliver services. And it's true that the corona crisis, because of the very nature, where we do need to have restrictions, we need to have restrictions for protecting human health. But these restrictions have, of course, a very severe effect on businesses and trade. When you can't move any people across borders anymore in the way that's needed, of course, you can't deliver services, many of them, the way it's needed. And there are necessarily obstacles also when it comes to transport and moving people, goods, services, ideas, innovations, anything that is needed for modern trade. So this makes the crisis quite exceptional, the speed, but also how many sectors are being affected, the fact that it touches upon all countries and regions, and that we have absolutely no certainty when the crisis will end. And this uncertainty, doubled with all the obstacles that are occurring, makes the crisis extra hard for companies to survive.
And the companies that you are talking to, are they sort of typically export-oriented companies, so they have problems getting their goods and services to the customers abroad? Or we're also talking about companies in Sweden that are import-dependent, that they may have problems as well, getting parts and components that are important for the production, for instance?
Well, of course, you make a very good point there, Frederick. We have a tendency of talking about Sweden as a small export-oriented country, but we are very much dependent on imports. And I think that this is not typically just the Swedish case, but any modern country today is very dependent on both exports and imports. When we look at added value and when we look at the amount of imports in our exports, it's clear that at least 1/4 up to 1/3 of our exports are actually made up of imports. This is one of the first signs of the crisis that supply chains are breaking down, and we can see that components are not reaching production, not reaching industries. For some, this is very dramatic. I mean, how can you put together a car when you don't have all the small bits and pieces needed from all over the world to make that car complete? So effectively, we're looking at the statistics. It seems like the imports have been a problem earlier than the exports. It's difficult to source inputs to the businesses and productions that are still up in business. And that's just one example. Difficulties of sourcing inputs for production. But we also see how very early on in the crisis, since the crisis hit in the world factory China, there was very quickly also a shortage of containers. That might seem like a detail, but it's not, because we need those containers, of course, for imports, but we also need, once we have emptied them, to fill them with exports going to perhaps different markets, different parts of the world with other products. And when these containers are available, they come at a higher price. And that, of course, might be difficult when goods that are exported are heavy and quite big in volume, which means, for instance, that wood becomes much more expensive to export than it was previously. So, of course, there are difficulties in transporting goods across borders, but we also have problems just having enough input in order to keep businesses going when they're still open.
Yeah, no, indeed. I saw somewhere a comment saying that, well, you need around 20,000 different parts and components to build a car, but it's enough just to miss one component in order not to build it. It's just that it goes to show.
Definitely. I think that we're actually, I mean, on the positive note, if we want to see something positive in this crisis, it is a perfect lesson on how trade actually works. We tend to talk about exports, less about imports. We tend to talk about goods, perhaps less about services and digital data flows. I think that what we see now is how very integrated modern trade is. And just like you say, Frederick, a car is made of all those pieces. And it's also made of services, of design, of research and development, of having people moving across borders, having the inputs necessary for production, and of course having markets to sell the cars to, having the necessary transports. So basically we are seeing how modern trade actually works, and we are also seeing what happens when there is an acute crisis to trade, where none of these flows that are necessary for trade are as easy as they are in the normal circumstances. What makes me a bit worried is not all the measures that are taken in order to prevent the spreading of the virus. Because of course we need to make sure that we control as much as possible the spreading of the coronavirus. And it is completely legitimate to take all the necessary actions in order to protect human health. I mean, that goes without saying, but I think we need to underline that still. What makes me a little bit more worried are all those actions that are less necessary, and that in times of crisis, we sometimes see how easy it is to give in to the protectionist instinct to close countries, to close borders, to close value chains more than necessary. Because I believe that one lesson that we need to learn from this crisis is that the crisis is certainly global. The virus is certainly global. It knows no borders. And we also need to really grasp the fact that the solutions are also necessarily global.
Yeah, no, indeed. And may I ask you, sort of on that note, on optimism versus pessimism, I think a lot of people are going to struggle here because on the one hand, we have developments around the world where, as you say, people have closed borders or governments have closed borders. We have seen restrictions that have been introduced, not just export curbs and the type of restrictions that you mentioned previously, but other measures as well. And they, of course, may be temporary. They may be sort of pulled back or taken away in a few weeks' time, a few months' time. But that's we're not sure about that, but hopefully they will. But we have sort of the general, I think, assumption among a lot of people that this crisis is basically the final nail in the coffin for a globalized economy in an open world. A lot of pessimism going around today, especially sort of in broader commentary. On the other hand, we can also see it, as you say, as the crisis as a good example to educate and learn about globalization, about how modern trade works, about integrated supply chain and how things work. And perhaps more broadly, we can also look at globalization more sort of as a way to learn from each other, as a mechanism of imitating good examples, of imitating positive developments in other countries. So we have globalization to spread knowledge, to spread innovation, to have sort of best practices to go around. And at least in some areas, I think we see an enormous activity in globalization today, with everyone trying to sort of learn from which society is doing what in curbing the pandemic and how successful are they. We have researchers at many different universities that collaborate in order to find a vaccine, antiviral medicines, etc. So in that sense, it's also a greater degree of intensity in globalization as it demonstrates that we really need to work together in order to solve a crisis like this. So how would you sort of weigh up these two different things between optimism on the one hand and pessimism on the other hand?
But I think you're completely right. I mean, let's just take a very simple example. Which country, the most developed possible, would even be able to produce all that is necessary at a national level to cope with the crisis? We're talking about face masks, of course, but we're also talking about research and development. We're talking about vaccines and everything that you need in order to cope with the crisis. There is absolutely no possibility that we can close the borders and each man or woman or country would be able to do this on their own. I think the example you started off with, the Mölnlycke example, is actually a quite a schoolbook example on how integrated we are and why we necessarily need to work more together globally and not less. This company produces necessary equipment to cope with the crisis. Swedish company, activity in, I think it's at least 40 countries around the world with customers in approximately, I think it's around 100 countries in the world. And of course, they source a lot of the inputs from other countries like Japan, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, but also Northern African countries. And they put together a lot of the products at Europe's sites. When we have distribution on the EU internal market, let's just remember that what the EU internal market is, it's about having the necessary flow of the free movement of people and goods, even data, services, investment across borders. I mean, in theory, it's as easy to trade between Stockholm and Paris as between Paris and Bordeaux. And that's the entire idea with a single market, that we have no borders. Of course, it's interesting, 500 million consumers, and it makes the EU internal market as a safe home market for all the businesses in Europe. Now, when there's an export ban, and I don't want to push just France because it's not the only country who put exports bans on the EU internal market, of course, that reduces the value of the internal market. And in the specific case of this company that you are quoting, that of course makes it very difficult for face masks and other equipment to reach the final consumer, to reach the final hospital and patient. So there's a suboptimal distribution of goods within the EU internal market. And that is troubling in itself, because it shows that the EU needs to be much stronger in times of crisis to reduce the threat of these rather protectionist instincts. So that's the first level. Let's keep the free movement on the EU internal market as fluid as possible. It is the most optimal distribution for customers, for companies, for hospitals and for patients. But then secondly, the EU put a joint export ban to the rest of the world. That, of course, affects companies like Mölnlycke as well, because they cannot export to the rest of the world anymore, and they have to export within the countries that are on the list. But that's not the real concern of a company like Mölnlycke, because the real concern is that when we put an EU export ban, which makes it more or less impossible, there are some exclusions, but normally it makes it impossible for EU companies to export to the rest of the world. What happens is that we risk a tit-for-tat, where other countries and other regions in the world are doing the same, putting export bans on their medical equipment, on their gloves and face masks, and their necessary equipment in order to deal with the crisis. We are very dependent in the EU of being able to source from where the products are the best, where they are the most effectively produced. Of course, we are entering into a very dangerous tit-for-tat, where the protectionist reaction is taking over, and that we will have a completely suboptimal distribution of food and other products, making trade more difficult. So this is not the direction that is the most suitable, neither to deal with the health crisis, nor to build up trade, international trade, after the corona crisis. If we think one step ahead, currently we see that the crisis has hit Europe quite hard. We now see developments also in the US, and we see China being back in business. What we cannot exclude is that there will be a second wave of corona spreading in Europe. We cannot exclude it. So there might be a situation where other parts of the world will be hard hit by corona crisis, perhaps the southern hemisphere, and that the coronavirus will be bouncing back in the autumn. We don't know. Nobody can tell for sure. What would be very, very unlucky and counterproductive is if we create a global system where we have export bans, restrictions, tariffs on all those goods that are hugely necessary in order to deal with this crisis. It's hugely negative for the recovery of the economy, of course, for businesses, and therefore also for jobs. And of course, at the end of the day, it does not make the access to the necessary medical equipment cheaper and more effective. It blocks the access to the necessary medical equipment. So it's suboptimal also from a health perspective. And that I think we need to have a true discussion about, because I think you're right, Frederick, that after the corona crisis, or when the corona crisis is less acute, there will certainly be discussions about whether globalization is a good thing or a bad thing, whether international trade is a good thing or a bad thing. And my dream would be that we stop having this dichotomy debate, whether it's good or bad, yes or no. We just need to realize the way that we are economically interdependent today, that the EU is one of the biggest successes when it comes to trade in the world, that we actually can have the free flow, and that it's not markets against health or what may it be, it's markets and health.
No, indeed. And to that effect, you and a couple of colleagues have also put forward a couple of suggestions for what we need to do at the European level right now in order to improve the working and the integrity of the single market and make sure that it also becomes a handmaiden for economic recovery as we hopefully very soon are going to move out of lockdown situations and where people can begin to return to not just economic life, but to social life more generally. So what would you say sort of are the most important things to be attentive to now when it comes to the EU single market?
When it comes to the EU single market, I think it's important that we look at all the flows necessary in order to make the single market function again. I mean, of course, we need to make sure that the temporary restrictions that are in many ways quite legitimate in order to stop the spreading of the virus, but we need to make those temporary obstacles and restrictions not become permanent. So it's very important that when we go back to a strengthening of the EU internal market, for the sake of our jobs, not the least, we need to remove the necessary obstacles that we had during the crisis and see that we make it as easy again to trade and to circulate in the EU internal market. But we need more than that. I mean, during the ongoing crisis, we can foresee that it will be difficult to cross borders for transport. The EU Commission made a very good initiative with the Green Lanes, the so-called Green Lanes, trying to make it easier for transport to cross borders. That is very welcome. We need to monitor that and to see that it works out well. But goods are not the only things crossing borders. We need also to make sure that key competences can move across borders. Now, key competences are not just those competences needed in order to combat the health crisis, but we do have key staff and very important competences that need to be able to cross borders. This is something that we need to look closer at. These key competences are not just to be defined by countries and governments, but we need also for companies and businesses to be able to define what the key competences are in order to assure the monitoring, for instance, of energy plants, where we necessarily need to have exports across borders, where we need to have people, working in the woods, working in the agriculture sector, that are not defined as key competences for everybody. So essential staff doing essential work that require them to cross borders, that we need to look into. Avoiding export restrictions for the EU internal market and globally, of course, is a no-brainer. We just talked about that, Frederick. But I think also we need to go back to what you said a few minutes ago about the necessity of imports, because as Europe will be opening up, there will be a difficulty in sourcing inputs, all those bits and pieces to put together the car, for instance, that you talked about. There will be difficulties in sourcing all this from Europe. And when there's a shortage of input goods that there are duties on, tariffs when we import them from third countries, the EU could easily, temporarily, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, for instance, choose to remove all the tariffs on necessary input goods that we don't have enough of within the EU. That is not a very difficult thing to do, and I think that is, in my view, quite a no-brainer as well. And I think also that all those fantastic free trade agreements that we have across the world that makes markets, for instance, in Canada, Japan, South Korea, soon in Vietnam as well, available, and where much of the trade is actually tariff-free. In order for companies to benefit from the zero tariffs in all those free trade agreements, there's a good system. I mean, I'm not going to get into the details, but we have what we call a certificate of origin, which means that we have to prove that a certain percentage of the origin of the good that is being exported from the EU to the country, like Japan or once again, or Canada, contains a certain percentage of EU content. Now, it's difficult to prove in these times when we have delays of administration, and also we have difficulties, as I said, in sourcing all those inputs from the EU. So another thing which might sound technical is that we could easily remove the necessity of certain certificates of origin in order to make it easier for companies to trade with the countries that we have free trade agreements with. But I think what we need to do, Frederick, on a more general level, is that we need to use the entire toolbox. This crisis is of an amplitude and a speed and a depth that we have not seen before. The corona crisis is, of course, very dramatic for human health, but it's also very dramatic for the EU internal market and for international trade, and thereby also for jobs. When we look at the figures, the WTO are talking about figures like 13 to 32% of decrease in global trade. And I think the chief economist of DigiTrade talks about almost 10%, 9.7% if I'm not mistaken. And this has a huge effect on jobs and people's lives. So what we need to do is that we need to be innovative and use the entire toolbox. National, of course, to do what's necessary, take the measures that are necessary in each country in order to stop the spreading, but now also to start to reboost the economy and thereby also the jobs. So I would not like to say never waste a crisis, because this crisis is of an amplitude that it's difficult to see any good coming from it. But let's at least make sure that when we take small steps out of this crisis, let's make the world a less protectionist world. Let's try to find the global solutions, and let's also refrain from putting up obstacles that finally, at the end of the day, always hit patients and consumers.
Indeed. And I think sort of what you've just laid out covers both, I would say, cyclical and short-term measures that are important now to restart economies, to make sure that inputs can be supplied to factories and others that need them in order to produce. And then we have another thing which is much more structural, and look at the capacity of trade, either trade in Europe or trade globally, to become a stronger vehicle for growth and welfare than it was at least before the crisis. I mean, it's always been a strong vehicle for improved living standards, but it tailed off a little bit in the past decade or so. And thinking a little bit more around those sort of structural elements and what we can do more there, I've seen a lot of commentary suggesting that economies that have gone through sort of a technological transformation, a digital transformation, that they have had an easier time to cope with the pandemic because they have had firms that could rely much more on, for instance, alternative supply of the services to customers. They had sort of internal in-house technologies like sort of customer relations management that could work even when these companies couldn't have staff in their offices because they had to stay at home. So I'm thinking here, I mean, is this also an opportunity to move ahead with policies that can help us to accelerate the digital transformation more than we've seen over the past 10 years or so? And if it's such an opportunity, what type of policies at the EU level is it that we need in order to accelerate it?
Well, I guess there can be many answers to that question, and it's certainly a good question for the years to come. First of all, I think that we need to avoid too much of headquarter thinking, because even in countries that connectivity level is high, such as Sweden, not everybody can work from home. We do have sectors, both in services, in hotels and restaurants, and in production, in manufacturing, in hospitals, in schools, where not everything can be done at a distance digitally. So we need to keep in mind that we are a happy few that can actually do our work from home, but that's far from everybody. What I think is abundantly clear is that the future will look different. We will not go back to the point where we were before the crisis. We will definitely, in all cases, both within the EU but also globally, we will be more digitalized. It's obvious that digital trade, digital production, the way communication works, has to be much more digitalized. I think another thing that is clear is that the recovery, when we start to reboot our jobs and economies and businesses again, we need to have a sustainable and green rebooting. We all have a responsibility in making the Green Deal a reality and also taking the Paris Agreement seriously. So it will be more digitalized, it will be definitely more greener. And I think also what we need to remember is that if we want to start nationalizing, like some voices are being raised now to say, nationalizing or reshoring, this is not necessarily a good thing for all the countries around the world. We need to think about how we can make international trade re-benefit everybody. And I think definitely that we need to reboost, I mean, this goes without saying as well, we need to reboost the negotiations within the World Trade Organization, the WTO, which is, I mean, let's go back to basics. This organization was founded in order to make sustainable trade benefit everybody. And we know how interlinked we are. We know how intertwined we are. And just like I said before, we cannot exclude that the coronavirus will spread elsewhere in the world and rebounds again. We are interdependent. We are truly connected. And we need to make sure that everybody's on the boat when we restart again. Free trade agreements, of course, are going to be necessary. But the WTO and reboosting the plurilaterals and the multilateral negotiations ongoing, we need to have that in focus. And I think that the EU has a very important role in doing this. We need the digitalization to go forward in negotiations, both in free trade agreements, but also in e-commerce initiatives in the WTO. And we need, of course, all the green initiatives. I would personally think that the environmental goods agreement, making a trade in environmental friendly goods tariff-free, would need to be reopened and reboosted. There are many things that we could do. And if we can learn from the crisis, that we need to be inclusive, global, digitalized and greener, then at least we would have drawn some of the right lessons from this crisis.
If we compare this crisis to the last crisis we had in 2008-2009, we at least then heard a lot from the World Trade Organization. We had even attempts by global leaders at that point to try to conclude the so-called Doha round of trade negotiations that then were ongoing. Leaders in Europe, in North America, in Asia, they made very, very strong commitments not to use protectionism as a method in order to protect their economies during an economic downturn and use beggar thy neighbor policies that perhaps would work in the short term for them, but eventually it would sort of bleed everyone's economies if countries started to go in that direction. In this crisis, we haven't heard much from the WTO. At least we haven't seen leaders asking for a lot more focus to be placed on trade. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, one point first about the lessons from the previous crisis, the 2008-2009 financial crisis. I think we need to remind ourselves that there was a very solemn promise from the G20 countries, the richest countries in the world, on the engagement that they have learned, that we have learned from previous crises, and that putting up barriers and going into the protectionist temptation is the wrong way to go. So all those countries promised that there would be no extra protectionist measures in order to make the recovery from the financial crisis more difficult. Now, did we keep that promise? Certainly not. We know that Global Trade Alert, but also the WTO and also the EU Commission and many others are monitoring in different ways on how this promise was kept or not in 2009. Now, we see that contrary to what was said, the amount of trade restrictive protectionist measures are much higher than the amount of liberalization. So first of all, we did not really keep promise after the financial crisis. We have a growing protectionism all around the world, and we need to see that this the face of protectionism is changing. Tariffs can be considered as a way of protectionism, but they are easy to deal with. They are transparent and they normally apply to everybody. And we know, except for the free trade partners, and we know also, we know them before, so they are foreseeable. We know that protectionism is changing. We are seeing barriers to the movement of people, the movement of innovation. We are seeing data localization requirements. We are seeing a new phase of protectionism. So I'm not sure that we actually drew the right conclusions from the financial crisis when it comes to international trade. Now, this time around, you're completely right. We have a quite silent WTO. But let's face it, the WTO is in a state of crisis itself. I'm not going to go into all the details about the appellate body and the judges necessary to make the appellate body function and the various tit for tat and trade conflicts around global players. But it's true that the WTO is being quite quiet. What is very sad is that in just a few weeks' time, the so-called ministerial conference was to be held in Kazakhstan. So every 2 years, now it was supposed to be in June 2020, all the member countries of the World Trade Organization meet for approximately almost a full week to boost the negotiations that are ongoing within the organization. Now, sadly, I mean, I think we never needed the World Trade Organization to step up as much as now. And sadly, this entire ministerial conference with the 164 countries present in Kazakhstan in June 2020 has necessarily been postponed because of the corona crisis. And it's easier to have bilateral trade negotiations, even between the EU and the UK with the Brexit negotiations, for instance. Some things can be done digitally, but you can't join 164 countries in digital discussions that are already quite difficult, even when we are all sitting, basically, and not all in the same room, but in the same building, in the same country, and in the same town. So I think that the WTO needs to be on the policymakers' minds, needs to be on the EU Commission's minds, need to be on the minds of the leaders of all the global players. We need to get back to the basics of the World Trade Organization to see that non-discrimination, transparency, making trade work for everybody is more important than ever. And this cannot be done by somebody vaguely called the WTO. It has to be done by the member states, which are members, the 164 members of the WTO. Here, the EU has a massive task, of course. And I personally regret that we cannot have this MC12 ministerial conference this year. It will probably be postponed to a more distant future. But we necessarily need to make trade a question of multilateralism again.
Anna, I think that was the perfect final words. Thank you so much for taking the time to participate in our podcast series. It was a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.